The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hey folks, I challenge you to think of at least one thing you no longer do that you wish you could. Do you miss like playing golf, maybe long walks with your spouse, sleeping through the night? Are you ready to start living without pain? My colleagues and friends, Hugh Hewitt, Dennis Prager, Mike Gallagher, have been talking about their own successful experience with Relief Factor, and you can add Eric Metaxas to that list. Relief Factor is changing the lives of tens of thousands of Salem radio listeners by reducing and even eliminating daily aches and pains. ReliefFactor.com is full of great success stories, and now I am on board. For just $19.95, Relief Factor is offering a three-week quick start that could help you live your life with little to no pain. Go to ReliefFactor.com to see testimonials from folks all over the country. I love reading them. Over 70% of those that try Relief Factor continue as a customer. Feel the relief and get back your independence and freedom from the aches and pains of everyday life. Go to ReliefFactor.com. Read the testimonies. I tell all my relatives to take it. ReliefFactor.com.
Hey there, folks. This is the Eric Metaxas Show in the bunker. We are now going to play a previously recorded pre-quarantine episode of the show with Amity Schlaes.
Welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show.
If you're drinking a beverage right now, please spit it out immediately.
We have reason to believe someone threw his gum in it when you weren't looking.
And now your host, Eric Metaxas.
Okay. Hey, folks. You know, we kid around a lot on this program, but sometimes we stop. And I believe eventually today I will stop, but not yet. Actually, right now I'm going to stop. I'm going to read something very serious. The Hill just wrote about the book, whose author I have in the studio. The book is called The Great Society, and the Hill calls it, it's about LBJ, okay, you've heard of The Great Society, but they call it a must-read book for this seminal election, recalls The Great Society. I have Amity Schlaes right here in this beautiful studio to talk about this important, now celebrated book. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You've got to be thrilled. I mean, come on. This is really wonderful. The Hill they called it a book of the year, I thought. Did I have that information correct?
Let's leave it at that. Someone told me that, but read from the article. Be accurate.
But I mean, look, you've written a book on LBJ and the Great Society. This story needed to be told. You've told it. I'm tickled just at that. But to be able to get you in the studio to talk about it and all the important ideas in it, I'm even more thrilled. So thank you for coming in here.
Thank you, Eric.
Let's start at the beginning. People are tuning in. They have no clue about the Great Society. They're young people tuning in. They don't even know what LBJ stands for. Would you tell those people, first of all, what you say in the book?
Well, imagine a time when young people are truly idealistic and socialism sounds pretty good to them.
Okay, like 1965, perhaps?
Like 2020, yeah. Or 1960.
Okay.
And the country's doing amazingly well. There are plenty of jobs.
Right.
And we look around and say, we can afford more. We can go from good, we're doing actually pretty well, to great. That's why it's called Great Society, not Good Society, because the ambition was to be great. So then the question becomes, how do you get to great? Well, there are two ways to attempt that greatness. One way is through the public sector, and one way is through the private sector.
Right.
Or the local, say the church, for example, the school. We opted collectively as a nation to attempt greatness through the public sector.
Okay.
That is, the government was going to redistribute,
okay,
to make
so,
America great.
To be fair, this is before we knew that it couldn't work.
Of course.
The way we now know that it couldn't work is because we tried it and it didn't work. But you know, here's the The good news is we at least spent zillions trying to make it work, and it didn't work.
We have an experiment, which is our history, but we have the record in seven or eight ways, Eric, in every field. But just the setting is people who are idealistic, people who are tired of their parents, people who want something better. And just to stick on that concept of great society, the phrase came from the Fabian socialists in England.
Remind us who the Fabian socialists are.
Nice drawing room socialists in England who eventually made the UK government very social democratic and therefore hurt the pound sterling and displaced England from being number one in the world to number two after the more actually capitalist United States.
I think the Fabian socialists are the people who stabbed the West in the face. But that's just me because they were evil. But so you're telling me that there was a time when it was fashionable, even more fashionable perhaps than it is today, to think that socialism might actually work. So we have to give these people enough just to be fair,
just
right?
Just to be fair, out of a sense of, it first starts with goodness. Am I fair, right? So even the British royalty said, well, we'll try it. There are quotes, if you ever want to go do the history of socialism, let's try some socialism. So, but actually, the man who wrote about the Great Society first said Great Society, by which he meant kind of big great, not amazing great. So he meant bigger than usual because society was confined to the village. There were no trains. There was no telegraph. And suddenly trains, telegraph, and national newspapers arrived. And that was the greater society. So naturally, though, this phrase in the American ear sounded like huge, wonderful, whatever, better than ever.
Awesome.
Awesome, supreme yeah. society. So and another historian a bit later, famous public thinker Walter Lippmann said, well, why don't we just try for the good society? Let's
is
be
that
a little
true?
Modest. Yes.
Walter Lippmann said, let's call it the good society, not the great society.
That's right. If you go back and look, he published a book, Good Society. And that was partly in reaction to an earlier experiment in greatness, which was the New Deal of the 1930s. So anyway, this phrase is around. It's in the American ear. And a new president comes, Lyndon Johnson. He became president because of a fatal tragedy when we lost John F. Kennedy. And Lyndon Johnson had a skill set. He was really good with Congress. There are lots of books about that. He's called Master of the Senate because he's so good at legislation. He had a second attribute, which is unbounding ambition. He wanted to be actually honor Kennedy by fulfilling the legislative agenda that Kennedy had failed to fulfill, but also wanted to be better than Kennedy. It's just the
he
way
didn't it, he didn't like Kennedy. Let's
he didn't
be,
really
let's be
like,
honest. Well, he hated him, and he was his vice president. And of course, this is politics, right? You trade on the tragic death of JFK to try to leverage that. It's like, we want to, if you love JFK, work with me now to make sure that his legacy is fulfilled. You know,
right.
And so that's but I
but,
guess
but,
you,
but
you have
so to you take those impulses.
But you have to answer this question before we go further, because I'm a little unclear on this. Did JFK have similar desires? In other words, was the Great Society part of what he had hoped to do? I wouldn't think so from what little I know of JFK.
So you think about what did JFK want in terms of greatness? Basically, on the foreign front, which was JFK's emphasis. He was a veteran. He'd been overseas. He wanted to win the Cold War. That's JFK's number one thing. Number two thing, he wanted to make things better at home, but that was definitely secondary. And then you look, what did he do? He had a few agendas, such as tax cuts, which would have helped the economy, betting on the private sector. And he had some public sector projects, mainly projects of his family who were more to his left. Right. But let me just finish this.
Yeah.
But so what did he actually do? He had these like juvenile help projects, which were later expanded into the Great Society. But the main thing he did is the space program. And the space program, we want to send very ambitious. Great. Get a man to the moon. But more symbolic, showing American discipline can yield great result, It's not the same as proposing national health care.
Actually, but I mean, I have to say I'm fascinated to hear you say. Now, look, I didn't say this in the beginning because anytime I know anybody, I don't give them a proper introduction. You're a presidential scholar at the King's College in New York. You're an historian. You've previously written about Coolidge. You're the head of the Calvin Coolidge Foundation. So just to get a sense historically here, when you talk about Kennedy the way you just did, because obviously we're getting to LBJ, but the way you just described him, he sounds like a conservative. He wants to win the Cold War. He wants to use technology to defeat the Soviet Union, at least symbolically, to take the wind out of their sails by putting a man on the moon. He cuts taxes. I mean, sounds like LBJ. I mean, it sounds like LBJ, what he did was a betrayal of JFK's legacy. And it sounds like JFK was almost a Reagan conservative.
Well, if you watch the debates between JFK and Nixon in 1960, what they're about is Kamoi and Matsu, two contentious islands, red Chinese, Russians, who are we fighting, right? That is his focus. I don't think JFK thought out his domestic agenda. So it's unfair to say he was a pure conservative like Ronald Reagan, where he really had thought a lot. JFK had never been a governor. He'd been a senator, huge difference. And he didn't really ever think, and as neither did really Nixon, about things like taxes, school busing,
right,
all this.
That's the problem. They didn't think about it. We're going to go to a break. I'm talking to Amity Schlaes. We're talking about what I believe The Hill is called the Book of the Year. We'll be right back. Folks, it doesn't get better. Supertramp, Amity Schlaes, come on. I'm talking to Amity Schlaes, who's the author of a brand new, really celebrated book. It is called Great Society, A New History. It refers, of course, to LBJ's Great Society, wanting to bring socialism to America. And I have to say, Amity, it's an important book. People, very important people, are saying very interesting, important things about the book. Alan Greenspan says Great Society is accurate history that reads like a novel covering the high hopes and catastrophic missteps of our well-meaning leaders. Alan Greenspan is the kind of guy who I don't think he says anything positive. He's way too careful for that. The Hill called it a must-read book, and the author of the article in The Hill says, I strongly recommend Great Society by Amity Schlaes. Strongly recommend. These people don't go out on a limb. I would give it like 20 exclamation points, but that's just me. But look, we joke around. What you've written about Amity is very important. It's very important for today. So we're going to get there. But right now we're talking about LBJ's predecessor, JFK. And so go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say about JFK is a president is just a collection of impulses, right? And he's also not the economy, and he's not the Congress. So JFK didn't have exact command of Congress. He had plenty of opposition in Congress.
Right.
He didn't get a lot of domestic stuff through, and he didn't really care because he was more – he had Cuban Missile Crisis and events like that.
So, you're talking about JFK.
JFK. I'm
right.
Sorry, I misspoke.
Yeah,
JFK.
Yeah.
So that was his presidency. I don't guess that his temperament was to build a giant national social welfare program in the way that it was LBJ's.
Well, for sure it was not. Let's be honest. There's no way that this is what LBJ wanted to do, but he was leveraging the death of his predecessor to pretend that JFK wanted to do those.
And the word great really appealed to him. His speechwriters came, Great Society, let's call it that. It was said he caressed the phrase. He was so happy with it. They told him to embargo it because he could use a big speech. Of course, he couldn't resist just dropping it on the Great Society. LBJ sounded wonderful to him because he was ambitious. LBJ, it was said he made laws like other people eat chocolate chip cookies. really good at it, didn't really think much about them, and really good at it. So he made a lot of laws. That was the Great Society in a number of areas. Congress was with him, particularly after 1964 when the Democrats got a big sympathy vote. People thought he was a strong leader. It was a rocky time. The president had been assassinated. So he had a blank check, he thought, to write the Great Society into existence. And he hired a lot of people who believed in it. And those people, less than LBJ, are the topic of my book. The people who thought they were doing right, the domestic best and the brightest.
Okay, so let's, as we were saying earlier, we want to be fair to say that they, of course, and look, people today who say, I believe in socialism, they believe they're doing the right thing. The only problem is we've now had many, many decades and many previous examples to see that, in fact, not only doesn't it work the way we'd hoped, but it's disastrous. So you get into that in the book. So let's get into that, first of all, and let's go back. With 2020 hindsight, we can see what we see. But from LBJ's perspective, he and others actually believed that we could leverage the wealth, the economy, to help everybody. So how does that go wrong?
Well, he said, I'm going to cure poverty. Cure. He didn't say make poverty better. He didn't say make life easier for people on poverty. He said, I'm going to cure poverty. So he abjectly failed in that. Our poverty number went down a bit, but then it flattened out at 10%. And that's where it is. So what what did he do wrong with just sticking to curing poverty? He called the most idealistic person he could to be his poverty czar. That was Sergeant Shriver, a man of great faith, by the way, a Christian, who believed that you can take what you do in the church in a local charity to the national level. You get more resources.
Or to put it another way, you can ignore the separation of church and state and shove your faith down people's throats. It's
again,
an interesting thing.
Very well-meaning.
Well, you know, look, Hitler was well-meaning, I think, and it doesn't. You don't get credit for that. It's what you do. So you're talking about a number of people who really believed. Look, we have to call it what it is. There's a tremendous hubris in this idea that we could somehow figure out the formula to quote unquote cure poverty. We're not talking about cancer. We're talking about something that is so. I guess let me ask this question. What was his most what were the most basic features of this plan, of this hubristic notion that you could actually wipe out something that's been with us, you know, forever?
Well, we created an office of poverty, and Shriver was ambivalent about going to work for LBJ because LBJ was a terrifying guy, and he was the brother-in-law of the former president, the late president. And he knew it was being used.
Shriver was.
Yeah, Shriver is
of
a
course.
Kennedy being brought in and therefore neutralized, being brought into the administration. And Shriver believed, and America believed, that his preceding project, which was the Peace Corps, had worked. In another show, we can talk about whether the Peace Corps works. But anyway, he thought it had worked. And so with all the domestic Peace Corps, they created an Office of Poverty. It was actually the Office of Economic Opportunity. They gave it a conservative name. A free market name. But what it was technically the following. All the mayors in America had poor people in their towns. Many of those poor people didn't vote and were sad or had bad living situations. Maybe they couldn't afford their rent. Maybe went with new machines, manual laborers were no longer needed, and there was unemployment, particularly among the least trained. That was the problem in the cities, in the north. So what Sergeant Shriver did, all those mayors had poverty offices. They had office, a training office for poor people, but they had that, right? They just didn't always have the funds for them because they were mayors. Shriver came along with LBJ and said, we're going to spend $1 billion, which was then a large amount.
In 1960-something dollars, that's a staggering
right?
number.
We're going to spend $1 billion to help the cities overcome poverty. And the mayor said, hurrah, let's get LBJ reelected. Think of Richard J. Daley, the iconic boss of Chicago. He has all his poverty plans in a drawer. He has a particularly effective political machine to execute on those poverty plans. Or Sam Yorty, who is the mayor of L.A., kind of a bantamweight gadfly type figure, but who had run on the idea of cleaning up L.A., including making the police force better. The police force was bigoted. Okay, so all this is going along, and LBJ wins, and he makes the poverty office. And Daley, for example, sends all his poverty ideas he expects LBJ Washington to fund in a box to Washington. Poverty for Chicago. Give me a large amount.
A literal box?
A literal box. It happened. And there's another book by Alan Matthews, so I like to mention all the other authors I've learned some of these things from. I recommend his book, The Great Unraveling. So anyhow, that is not what Sergeant Shriver does. He doesn't open Daley's box and say, I'm writing checks for these things. He said, no, we want our own poverty outpost in Chicago. We're going to kind of ignore Daley, Yorty, every mayor in the United States. We're going to ignore those people because we don't quite, they're the machine, right? They're the old machine. We need new enfranchising freedom groups, and we're going to kind of create the groups we want to give the money to, or at least be there, midwife them. And they picked succeedingly more and more left-wing groups. And so those groups were for things like occupy the mayor's office, you know.
This is in the mid-60s.
In the mid-60s. And actually, because he was naive, principally, Sergeant Shriver permitted handbooks and so on to be written. Enfranchising the local voter means that they should participate in politics. And you can actually look at the language. Developing a protest culture or something like that is in the language of the handbook. I'm paraphrasing. So I want to bring it to you. I'll email it to you. You can mention it on another show. But it was something creepy like that.
Yeah.
It was something that gave license. And then the students who became the leaders of the SDS were involved, Students for a Democratic Society, left-wingers, but not yet as terrifying as they later became. You know,
they
were involved in this, too.
Very terrifying.
And the labor unions were for it, too. The leader of the mighty United Auto Workers, Walter Reuther, had his own little poverty offices that were more favored by the government than the mayor's. And Mayor Daley was furious. He called up the White House and said, does the president know what he's doing? He's sending M-O-N-E-Y, Daley spelled it out, to
Troublemakers.
And that, again, is a paraphrase. We have to look in the book. But he's sending M-O-N-E-Y, Daley said, to the wrong people, not my people. Guess who elected him? Me. Richard J. Daley.
I made you, you bum. Forgive me, Amity. So, we're going to go to a break.
So that's,
we will allow you to complete these and other thoughts when we return. Very important conversation about the Great Society. I used to be a rolling stone, you know. If a cause was right, I'd leave to find an answer on the road. Hey there, folks. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. I'm talking to Amity Schlaes about her brand new book. It's an important book called Great Society, A New History. Amity, you were just making several important points, and we had to go to a break. Please continue.
Well, the main point is the mayors were absolutely appalled at the Great Society because the money wasn't going to them, and it was going to people who were going to run against them in the next election.
Let me ask you, though, because I'm not really clear on this. Were these mayors mostly Democratic mayors?
Republicans as well.
The
mayors were going to create, the money was going to create political groups who might challenge sitting incumbents, whether they were Democrats or Republicans. So they were like, wow, really? Oh, you're bringing something ugly to Syracuse, and I don't like it. You're bringing something ugly to Chicago. And what was the point? The point was to use the money to teach people how to become more enfranchised citizens. Great. What is it? So eventually some money went to the Blackstone Rangers through the Woodlawn Organization in Chicago, which was a gang. Why would that? What is the argument for that? There is an argument. I mean, we, the U.S., have supported this in the nation of Colombia. When you have a vigilante group that's creepy, if you bribe them, they become the police force, quote unquote, and are on the side of peace. So the argument here would be the Blackstone Rangers prevented riots on the south side of Chicago or greater riots when Martin Luther King died. Or the Blackstone Rangers will prevent Martin Luther King assassination magnitude riots. That's crazy, by the way. You enable thugs. When you enable an extra legal group, you're doing the
wrong thing. This is like funding. We have to make it try to bring it into the present, right? It would be like funding groups related to Antifa.
It would be either way, right? If you would get George Soros, the big
– which he's effectively doing.
Right.
George Soros is funding groups related to Antifa and other groups like that, that they are – they're thuggish. They are hyper left-wing. I guess my question is, did LBJ and Shriver realize that what they're doing is just – in other words, rather than helping people help themselves or helping mayors help their towns – They were kind of doing a big federal overreach.
They realized the overreach part because they thought it was righteous. They didn't realize they were going to fund violence. They thought there would be, you know, some nice sit-ins. One of the biggest critics was a Democrat, John Connolly, the governor of Texas. Who had been right there, who sort of had a halo around his head, frankly, because he'd been right there with JFK and had been wounded. And everyone knew the pictures. And also, I will say something about John Connolly. He's a very tall man. So in that bullying mode that LBJ had, people, when he entered the room, you kind of cowered. So John Connolly said, "What are you doing? You're sending money to left-wingers in my state. Don't you realize your programs are kind of boondog?" He used that phrase. The people down here think there's a boondog. And there were all kinds of rules that appeared perverse, such as minimum wages that were related to the government programs. And John Connolly said, well, if that's the minimum wage, that's too high for Texas. We're going to lose jobs to another state if you drive up our wages. Actually, a very accurate analysis of what happens when you put upward pressure on wages in a locale. Businesses have to live with that, but they don't, so they'll withdraw to Texas. Well, he knew that one of Texas's great advantages was relatively low wages, and he didn't want to sully that reputation. So he criticized too, and Johnson was like, oh, well, we better stop some of this, and he tried to rein in Shriver, but it was kind of too late. I want to mention one last thing about the poverty office. One of the things it did that was particularly creepy was it created a legal services department. And here, one of the intellectual leaders was the Attorney General, Robert Kennedy. Kennedy believed that it was time for pro bono to mean more than the lady in your church or synagogue or community who's being beaten by her husband needs a lawyer to get a divorce, or some local case. The man was robbed by the police and he needs a lawyer to win against these bad police and the bad police chief. Kennedy gave a speech at the University of Chicago Law School, which was an equivalent speech to that his brother gave, saying his brother had said, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Essentially, RFK said, ask not what the law can do for you, you fat little University of Chicago graduates, ask what you can do for the law. And what he specifically meant was you must pursue professionally public interest law, not just the random case from your well-heeled firm, professionally, and also class actions, not individual cases. So they had a little law office, Office of Legal Assistance, where they funded legal assistance across the United States from the Poverty Czar office. And that very quickly turned into a funded network of 1,000 lawyers who were mounting class action states all over the country against their own states very often. So, for example, the class action public interest law firm in California, known as the CRLA, California Rural Legal Assistance, sued Governor Reagan for reforming welfare. And he said, wait a minute, my constitution says I have to balance the budget. States have that constraint, thank God, too. And I'm doing the right thing because welfare is growing just wildly right now under JFK, LBJ, and Nixon. It was up to Nixon. This institution still exists. I don't want this law firm to be here. I don't want these young Turks to be suing me, stopping me doing my job as governor.
Right.
So that was later, but that was the poverty law, Shriver, LBJ begat what became large-scale legal action.
To know how this all happened, first of all, thank you, Amity. We're going to be right back to continue the conversation. But it's just so vital we understand how we got to where we are today. We'll be right back talking about this great book called Great Society.
It's interesting.
You got me running, going out.
Okay, be honest. How many people listen to this program for the bumper music? Raise your hands. I know you're out there. You don't want to listen to these intellectual conversations about history and stuff, but I do, and it's my show. So, Amity, thank you for enjoying the bumper music. Also, this is how I know we're around the same age. We were at Yale around the same time, and I know that we like some of the same music, but we're talking about much more important stuff right now. Your book, Great Society, talks about, effectively, how we got here, how it all started. Now, you've written a previous book. What's the title of The Forgotten Man? About, tell us.
The Great Depression. So you want to think of successive waves of idealism. Yeah. We're in a wave of idealism now.
Right.
There was a wave of idealism in the early 30s. There was also a crisis, a genuine crisis. One in four men was unemployed. When Franklin Roosevelt was running for president for a moment, and the unemployment was severe and abiding, though not always that high. So we said, we're going to have a new deal. That is, we're going to fix it all up. And that didn't work too well either. And the reason The Forgotten Man, it was quite a contentious book. A lot of people made an effort to trash it. And I was curious to see why. And it was because people want to believe in Franklin Roosevelt.
And people want to believe in the Great Society and socialism, which is why people don't really talk so much about LBJ these days. I think in part because we recognize that his war on poverty and this, you know, the Great Society failed. And they didn't just fail. I think, as we mentioned earlier, they failed spectacularly because they have cost us zillions and zillions. And they have, if anything, made things worse. You detail how this all happened in your new book, which is getting, I think, very well-deserved accolades. The book is Great Society. We were just touching on a strange subject. We were just touching on how Richard Nixon, while being staunchly anti-communist, was in domestic policy not what we would at all think of as a conservative.
What do presidents want? They want to be loved. They want to be reelected, and they want to have a passable coalition to pass their laws. That's basically it. So Nixon was actually a fabulous candidate. If you ever are interested in the arguments for strong defense or even something about markets and common sense vis-a-vis social protest, you go and listen to Nixon in 1968. He had a wonderful group of people around him, including the later Fed chairman, Arthur Burns, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who switched parties for him at great peril, a social peril.
Wait a minute. You don't mean that Senator Moynihan became a Republican?
No, but he went and served
Nixon. You mean
Nixon.
That he served Nixon, right? Well, but Moynihan was that rare thing. A principled thinking Democrat.
That's right. Well, he was. There's a nice book by Greg Wiener called about Moynihan as Burke. That is, he wanted to participate in government, even if it was imperfect, even if there was a cost to his personal reputation, which there sometimes is when you work for the enemy party in the way movement people think.
Right,
and so
right.
That was noble of Moynihan to at least endeavor. A number of other names we know all went over to work for Nixon. And lo and behold, what do they discover? He doesn't have great support in Congress. He wants to woo Democrats. So instead of narrowing the number of people who receive food stamps, which everyone had expected him to
do.
Nixon allows the number of food stamps to grow, the amount given out. And, well, you know, the agriculture lobby wants that, right? And then instead of abolishing the poverty office, he edits it, puts friends in the office. One was a name we know now, Frank Carlucci, a diplomat. There's some others. In and tries to keep it to placate Democrats or centrists and edit it to placate more free market Republicans. And the hilarious fight that ensued, Nixon didn't turn out to be a real Republican. So America was already looking at Reagan, who was governor of California, and they clashed over this federal assistance to California.
Because Reagan was a true conservative with
right.
a conservative vision, whereas Nixon obviously didn't know what he thought on that. I mean, when you think that, what did he create? Did he create the EPA or the Department of Education. I mean, he grew government.
He grew government under the Trump. Imagine this is a stage and we have these actors and in the background is rumble, rumble. That's Vietnam War. Rumble, rumble, rumble. Rumble gets louder, drowns out people on stage. We went from 50,000 men to 500,000 men in Southeast Asia. That's why one reason LBJ chose not to run again, at least he said. In 68, he felt that he had to be a principal leader, not a campaigner, with that many men for whose lives he was responsible. So it's already going down under Nixon, but that's the rumble, rumble in the background. I argue that the domestic policy was just the flip side of the foreign policy, of the war policy, with the same errors, which is that you can control everything if you're brilliant. So anyway, in this particular case, Reagan had a veto over.
What year are we talking about?
We're talking about in Nixon's first term. So it would be like, right. I'm sorry, I don't know which year, but 70 or 71, something like that.
Yeah.
Reagan had a veto over this big spending on law firms to fight Reagan's state. But the veto could be overridden by the federal government. Still, Nixon did not want Reagan to veto. Splashy governor headline. Reagan veto says, I don't respect you, federal government.
Yeah.
So he sent an emissary to deal with Reagan.
Nixon did.
Yes, he did. That was Carlucci. And they met in a hotel room. The person who met was actually Ed Meese, who later became attorney general. That was Reagan's person. Great man. And the Nixon team said, kind of talking condescendingly to Reagan team, there are two scenarios how this can play out. One is the A movie. We have a big fight and you look like fools because we win. And the other is the B movie. We reconcile and we do something for you and you do something for us. And you don't veto and humiliate President Nixon. Meese goes in the other room, phones Reagan, the governor, comes back and says, we choose the B movie. Then Reagan sends Carlucci a bottle of liquor because they have a pretty good deal. Reagan gets support for his welfare reform, manages actually to do so well with welfare, to cut the rolls, that's one of his centerpieces when he later campaigns. But he doesn't embarrass Nixon with a flamboyant veto of
right.
Nixon's legal assistance, which Nixon shouldn't be for, by the way, in the first place, if he's a Republican.
Although I'm amazed that Reagan was somehow willing to go along with that. But okay, we're going to go to break. We're going to be right back. We're talking to Amity Schles. If you want to spell it, so do I. It's S-H-L-A-E-S, Schles. The book is Great Society. We'll be right back. Folks, that's Stevie Wonder, American Taxes. I'm talking to Amity Schles about her brand new book, an important book, a great book titled Great Society, A New History about LBJ's Great Society, which wasn't all that great. That's the point of the book, the point of the conversation. And it's how we got here. It's how we got to AOC and Bernie Sanders. Can we talk a little bit about that? Because the idea that all this, how much money was put into LBJ's, you know, war on poverty? We're going to cure poverty.
Trillions. And we didn't. I honestly think this is about, if people talk about nostalgia and hope, you know they're not real, right? They say, oh, it was so great in the past, or it might be good in the future. Data actually matter, and the data aren't great from this period. Both parties, everyone knows that Bill Clinton turned against welfare and did a welfare reform. He said the age of big government is over. Both parties saw that it was an embarrassing failure. The consequences we live with now, the legacy now, is that our children will pay much higher taxes than we will and likely have a worse economy because of commitments made in the Great Society. So if you look at New Deal commitments, you know, we have progressive waves in America, Social Security and stuff, and you look at Great Society commitments, we spend more already on Great Society than we do on New Deal. That is on Medicare and Medicaid.
It is unbelievable. I guess I should ask. I mean, maybe the fundamental, and we're going to keep you into the second hour because I want to get into a few things we haven't touched on here. But when you talk about the failure of the Great Society, isn't the fundamental idea that we haven't mentioned, I ought to have mentioned it in the beginning of the conversation, is that there has been a myth, and the myth persists today. It is that government and money can fix our problems. It's a simple idea. It's been tried. It has failed dramatically, horribly. And the reason you have to write a book like this is because it is with us today. There are people who think that if I throw money at the problem, or if I have a big government program, I increase the government, whatever, we can actually solve these problems. The fact is, not only is that not true, but it always works in the reverse. It couldn't be more ridiculous.
It tends to work in the reverse. It always works in the reverse. But idealism is a funny thing. It allows you to deny reality. One of the stories in my book, one of the most absurd things was the left-winger Tom Hayden, who was just a student activist at the beginning of the book, kind of, you know, just what you think, decides he's going to investigate socialism. And he goes all the way to Hanoi, which must have been irritating to Lyndon Johnson, who halted a bombing campaign around that period. And I'd like an interesting researcher to prove to me that LBJ knew that an American student was in Hanoi and therefore was, you know, taken care of, didn't have a bad headline. Anyway, Hayden goes there, and Hayden loved Hanoi. He fell in love or fell in crush with a girl there. He thought the brave people had a socialism of the heart.
And this is before he fell in love with Hanoi Jane.
Right, before he fell. A socialism of the heart was the phrase that he used. And he thought, these people are like us. They sang Kumbaya together. It was just like when in the South we sang We Shall Overcome. He analogized where there was no analogy, unwittingly ignoring the Soviet support for the missiles that were shooting down American planes. And that's socialism. And kind of cynically, I think he said to himself, I'm not sure I'm for socialism, but I can see it's a great movement builder. And you never, the beauty of socialism is it's never finished, so you never have to apologize for it.
This is, and that's why we know it's actually Marxism. We're done with this hour, but Amity, the doors are locked. We're going to continue talking to you about your book, Great Society. Folks, don't go away.